Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a look at the ice-free planet and the failure of governments and institutions to meet the challenges of climate change. My guest today from Cambridge University in Cambridge, United Kingdom, is Professor Peter Wadham. He is a professor of ocean physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University. He's also the former director of the Scott Polar Research Institute, and he's recognized as a renowned scientist in the field of Arctic regions, understanding the impact of climate change on them, the rapid loss of polar ice, and he has also participated in 50 polar expeditions. His recent book, published in the United Kingdom and due for American release at the end of the summer, is A Farewell to Ice, which is a frontline report from a world leader and outlines his dire warnings about an ice-free world in the event humanity fails to meet its challenges. Now, normally I would be doing this interview from our radio station through, you know, our normal technical means. However, because I'm on a telephone today on location, you will not have the same technical qualities you normally would. Let's say hello to Peter at Cambridge University. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks.
You were on my noon broadcast speaking on the long-term changes in the melting of the Arctic ice and the various positive feedback loops that are triggering catastrophic climate change and extreme weather. I encourage listeners to hear that interview in the archives because you spoke about several of the most important ones, such as the increased albedo of the Arctic Ocean and the changes in jet streams and extreme weather patterns and the release of methane gas from under the sea and the melting of the permafrost. I remember only 10 years ago when I was covering climate change issues, people rarely spoke about feedback loops. It was the climate-changing tipping points that were the focus of discussion and controversy. Now scientists have identified dozens of positive feedback loops, so it appears that there are likely other feedback loops lurking in the future that we aren't aware of yet, or some trace of loops that are not fully understood yet. And this coupled with our current predicament of not being able to be honest and forthright about how serious it is. The larger issue is the mainstream media, even alternative media, have led us to believe that, yeah, some things are happening, but it's long off in the future, way after you have died, so don't worry about it. And I'm looking every day, like yesterday in Phoenix, Arizona, it was 118, the day before 119. Planes were not allowed to take off because it was too dangerous. And I was out in Phoenix recently, and I asked some people, do you know where your water comes from? No. Well, do you know you have no natural aquifer here? It's coming from Little Colorado, you know, a long way off, in a hundreds of million dollars deal where they gave you, if you built that canal, they would give you the water, but they're running out of water, and they supply 40 million Americans in the Southwest, like all of Nevada's water, and a lot of the other countries and the states, including California, with their water. So you're all equally vulnerable. When water is no longer available because the snowpack is not there, the ice is not there, melting over a six-month period to gradually release water into the river that goes into the aquifers and into the other bodies, where are you going to get it? I don't know. And the Grand Agalaga water filter, the largest in the United States, covering 6 to 7 states, it's half gone, 50% gone. In fact, it's so low in some regions, there's no water to be drawn from it. So what's going to happen to our breadbasket, Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, South Dakota, when they can't draw water up to irrigate their crops? I don't know. And so we're looking daily at catastrophic events, and no one seems to be willing to pull these pieces of the puzzle together, to pull back and look at the larger picture. They're looking through the lens of bias, denialism, avoidance, or not wanting to hear anything bad, and the media never likes bad news, unless in some way it can manipulate it for sensationalism. But on this issue, people are tuned off and turned out. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree. I think the level of awareness of what's happening with climate change and with resource depletion, which is the problem of water, is very variable. I mean, I find it's low in Britain as well as in America, but it's quite a lot higher on the continent of Europe. I was recently in Milan and in a taxi and talking to the driver about what I was doing and where I was going, and he said spontaneously, "Oh, he's very pleased that Milanese taxis are white because it means they have a higher albedo and they reflect more radiation and keeps them cooler." And he was aware of the word albedo, which most people are not, and even many scientists are not. So I was really impressed by his level of awareness of what's happening with climate. And I think Europe's awareness and desire to really take very seriously the terms of the Paris Agreement on reducing emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and trying to see us through to a more stable climate is very strong, and in a sense made stronger by the fact that Britain's leaving the European Union, because it means the remaining countries work together more strongly. So it does look as if perhaps Europe and maybe China will be the leaders of doing something about climate change, given that America, which is the natural leader, has just now subject to the destruction of Trump.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. If all Arctic ice and Greenland ice sheets disappear, what is the likely range of sea level rise that would result, even if partially? And in my opinion, and if I'm wrong, please challenge me on it, once you start losing, let's say, let's just use Antarctica for example. Right now you can fairly well predict with mathematical models how much the sea would rise based upon the current melting and projected melting. But once the Larsen Sea Shelf, which is over 110 miles wide, along 300 feet wide and over almost 3/4 mile deep, when that breaks off and it's the size of Delaware, that means that there's no backstop to that entire area of glacier that's going to fall into the water. And once that's on a, and it is on a high slant, it's a over 20 degree slant, once that starts to calve in, then the pressure behind it mounts, and then the front calving allows more calving, and you could have massive amounts, just unfathomable amounts of calving going into the water, which would not take 100 years to raise the sea a foot. It could do it in a relatively short period of time, and scientific models today are not predicting anything based upon mass calving. They're basing it upon an older model, and the same is true with Greenland. Once it starts, and you start losing a great deal of water from the glaciers and the heating, it can speed up. So could you explain the phenomena of chaos theory? In effect, we're now in chaos theory. There's no real mathematical models that can say you don't have to worry for 30 years or we'll only have 2 inches rising in the next 20 years. It can happen a lot faster than that. It can happen within relatively short periods of time once that loop starts.
Yes, you're quite right. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is supposed to be dealing with these matters, tends to adopt a kind of conservative position or complacent position, which is that the sea level rise due to melt of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet will be a linear rise, that the rate of rise that we're getting now due to beginnings of melt of Greenland and Antarctica will continue to simply cause a linear rate of rise, and that will give us less than a meter of sea level rise in, by the end of the century. But the trouble is, the rise is not linear; it's exponential, because as sea level as the melt begins on these continents, the rate increases more than linearly because we're opening up holes in the Greenland ice sheet called Mulang, which down which the meltwater falls and lubricates the bed. These changes are happening at more than a linear rate, and so we're going to get a steadily increasing rate of sea level rise, and an exponentially growing rate will give us far more than a meter by the end of this century. We won't notice it at first as the rate starts to accelerate, but after it's been accelerating for a while, it really has a big effect. It's like compound interest. That's for Greenland, but for Antarctica, as you say, there's these additional factors, which is that there are certain instabilities which could cause large chunks of the ice sheet to come loose. There's the loss of the Larsen ice shelf, which gets rid of a protective skirt of ice along the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula. And once that's gone, then the existing ice sheet on the peninsula, which is a very steeply sloping ice sheet, will flow much more rapidly, and there'll be a big increase in the flow of ice into the sea. And then there's another one in the Pine Island Glacier, which is another unstable location along the Antarctic coast, where as a little bit of melt will cause the ice sheet there, the floating ice shelf, to become detached completely from the underlying rock, and anything could happen there. I mean, that could produce a big loss of ice shelf from an area where that would be replaced quickly by ice going out to sea. As you say, it's sort of chaos theory, because you've got complacent predictions of linear rises. We should be using exponential values because everything's accelerating. But on top of the acceleration, there's a possibility of jumps due to catastrophic events like the loss of or detachment of an ice shelf from the continent. And that can produce really unpredictable, but certainly large, increases in the rate of sea level rise.
There's one other factor, and that is that they have now detected, both in Greenland and in Antarctica, large inner ice lakes. And when the top layer or one of the outside layers melts down to that, you will have a phenomenal amount of water released that has been trapped for thousands of years inside there. And they're talking about what impact that would have. When you look at all these feedback loops, could you go through the ones that you're concerned about, explain them, and why they should be given more attention than what they're given to the American public? And the American public is not told about the specifics on any of this. It's just little news bites. All the weather yesterday was set a record, you know, in Phoenix. And well, what does that mean? Tell me what that means. You mean yesterday was hottest ever, but today it's 1 degree less, and so that's okay. As now, let's go on to the next news story. So go through the feedback loops and the tipping points you're concerned about. Explain, please, how these could end up impacting other feedback loops, and then what that could mean for the people in different parts of the world.
Okay, well, I guess the most serious feedback from associated with the loss of sea ice is the albedo feedback, just like the Milanese taxi driver said. That is to say, sea ice retreats in summer, and you're replacing an area that was covered with white, with snow and ice, by dark, which is open water. And that will take your albedo down from 80%, that's a surface which reflects about 80% of the solar radiation that falls on it, to something less than 10%. So an open water surface absorbs more than 90% of the radiation. And that's a massive change. So the retreat of sea ice, which is due to the warming of the climate and therefore the melt of the sea ice, has this extra effect, which is that it reduces the albedo of the planet, and quite significant reduction. That that's made worse by the fact that the warming also is causing the snow line to retreat in the Northern Hemisphere. Lots of areas of Canada, Alaska, which would be snow-covered almost year-round, or certainly right into the summer, are now finding themselves snow-free. And that is the same thing. You're replacing a white surface by a dark surface of land. And if you add those two together, it's equivalent to adding 50% to the direct warming effect of the Earth due to us releasing greenhouse gases. So we release the greenhouse gases, we warm the climate, we melt the sea ice and melt the snow, and that melt in itself causes a 50% additional increase in warming because of the albedo change. So it's the beginning of a kind of runaway effect. One effect is causing a bigger one elsewhere. So that's I think the biggest and most worrying effect is the albedo change. But coming along close behind, there's others. One is the as we've mentioned, the sea level rise. That the sea level used to be very slow, and it was associated mainly with the fact that as the ocean warms up under global warming, the water becomes less dense and it stands higher, so that the surface of the ocean is higher than it used to be. That gives you sea level rise. And then on top of that, there was some small addition of water that had run off from retreating glaciers in the Rockies, the Alps, and all the mountain regions that have glaciers. They're retreating, and that puts water in the ocean. But today, we've got a big extra boost to sea level rise due to melt of the Greenland ice sheet and the beginnings of melt of the Antarctic ice sheet. That hadn't even begun to happen 30 years ago. We didn't. There was no melt of the Greenland ice sheet. Now there is every year, and increasing amounts each year. And so that sea level rise acceleration will be something that we'll notice more and more, and it will be causing very big effects in the third world, of course, flooding events along very vulnerable coastlines like the coast of Bengal, where millions of people live in poverty, and they'll be having more frequent floods, but also flooding of big cities in the West. Because sea level is a universal thing. It's that water finds its own level. So the sea level doesn't just rise in some parts of the world. It rises everywhere, and it will mean that cities like Miami, obviously New Orleans, but also New York, are going to be threatened by their actual existence is threatened. That's certainly the case with Miami, that because if a lot of as the city is down near sea level, or if there's other factors, like in the case of Miami, the fact that the underlying rock is porous, and you're going to get sea level rise that will actually cause coastal parts of those cities to become uninhabitable, to be basically underwater. And they tend to be the most expensive real estate, so there'll be an economic impact as well. So sea level rise is a inexorable one-way route. It's going to keep on accelerating, and nothing we can do about it, because it's a flywheel effect. Even if we reduce our carbon emissions successfully so that we slow down global warming, the rate of loss of melting ice sheets has got a very big kind of reservoir of heat is involved there, and that sea level rise due to those ice sheets melting will continue to accelerate for a long time to come. That's number two. And I suppose those are happening, and we can't do anything about it. But one something that we don't know if it's happening or not is going to be whether we'll suffer a methane pulse. Methane is being released into the atmosphere at the moment from the shallow seas off the Arctic coastlines of Russia, all the way along from Bering Strait to the Norwegian border. You've got a succession of very shallow coastal seas, less than 100 meters deep. That's the East Siberian Sea, the Laptev Sea, the Kara Sea, and so on, Barents Sea. And these seas have got sediments underneath them, which carry huge amounts of methane in the form of methane hydrates, which is a kind of solid material of frozen water encapsulating methane. The only reason that isn't all coming out into the atmosphere is that there's a cap of offshore permafrost left over from the last ice age, which is holding this methane down. And this permafrost is now in the process of melting very rapidly, the reason being that the sea ice is retreating in the summer now, so you get open water on these shelves, and open water can warm up very fast in summer because it's absorbing a lot of solar radiation. So this warm water along the shallow shelf seas of the Russian Arctic is melting through the permafrost, and methane's being released in increasing quantities. In the summer now, we're seeing huge bubble plumes of methane coming out of the ocean, and the amount is rising year by year. It's causing the global methane levels in the atmosphere to rise in a measurable way. But the fear is that this loss is just the beginning of what could develop into a kind of huge pulse of methane, as a lot of the rest of the methane in these sediments comes out within a very few years. That would in itself give you an instant global warming of, which could be up to, say, 0.6 of a degree. That's the figure we got from our modelling of what was going on. And 0.6 of a degree just added in 2 or 3 or 4 years to the planet would be catastrophic. I mean, we're trying to keep global warming within 2 degrees, but this is over several decades. We don't want global warming to rise by more than 2 degrees by the end of the century if we're going to try and control climate to the point where not everybody's going to be wiped out. But here we're going to add 0.6 of a degree, maybe in just 2 or 3 years from a methane pulse. That would be really catastrophic. And we should be doing something about it. We should be researching every possible way we can think of to hold that methane back, to say what's been proposed has been something like fracking on land, where you drill underneath and open up some cavities for it to flow into, and then you can collect it or flare it off. But in fact, we're not doing anything. We're hoping the whole thing goes away. There's an extra complication that it's in Russian waters, and the Russians are not keen to let anybody in there to do anything. And so there's a real major threat to the planet there, going completely unrecognized and not without any research being done on how we might counter it. So I would view that as a feedback that we should be very, very concerned with, and we should be involved in really high-level negotiations with the Russians.
I have a couple of thoughts on that. And this, I realize it's a hypothesis, but it's a reasonable hypothesis based upon your expertise. If, as others have suggested, other climatologists have suggested, that we may be seeing an ice-free Arctic later this summer, early fall, and again next year, and that means that an awful lot of dark water exists that will absorb in that sun and then melt even more of that permafrost and allow more methane to come out. Tell us what is possible, a worst-case scenario, So at least we have an idea on a spectrum of nothing will happen to how bad it could get because, and I'll tell you why. I remember, I lived in Miami Beach, actually South Beach, on 2nd and Ocean Drive, right on the water for 15 years. And I just sold my place there about 3 years ago. And I would run every morning. That was one of the joys of me being there. I would run up the beach, do a 10-mile run. And it was quiet. It was early in the morning. And I saw three phenomena over a period of years. And it wasn't all at once. It was gradual. And one was that barges were coming in, bringing in sand, and then bulldozers would bulldoze the sand over the whole beach. And I would talk with some of the people, you know, and what's going on here? What am I seeing? Well, we're running out of sand. In fact, this is not just here. So all up and down the whole eastern United States, but also we don't have a local place where we can get sand. We're now going down to the Bahamas, and I understand now that's been used up in the Bahamas selling a sand, and now they're going to other places to buy sand. They bring it in because people go to Miami Beach to be on the beach, and if you don't have a beach, then they're not going to go there. And I saw huge amounts. But I also saw something else. Every morning I would see, as the tide goes out in the morning, you see seaweed left like a line straight up a beach, an embarkation line. You see where the tide come up. And over a period of years, I saw it coming further and further and further. We're not talking about any storms. This is just normal tide surge at night. Mm. And in the year before I sold my place, I actually saw it come up so far that it was actually the seaweed you could see on the bottom of the swimming pools, which were the furthest extension towards the ocean. And I said, what's under all these buildings? Tens of thousands of buildings going clear up Florida and Carolina and Georgia. What you have is you have sand. You do not have rock. And so you have concrete stanchions that are sitting on sand, just like in Dubai, and those are going to, in time, be pulled out, meaning they're going to have cracks in them, which is going to cause cracks and structural adjustments in the building themselves. And at a certain point, they won't be able to fix them. They'll have to simply abandon the buildings. But that also would mean, politically, you've got to condemn a whole area that you can't build on it anymore because you're susceptible to construction defects. That means then you'd be putting the public at risk. That means that everybody would rush to sell their property, and that's the most expensive property we have is oceanfront property. That also means that the taxes to the local communities would go down, cities would go down. You wouldn't that then have the budgets for the normal repair and maintenance and services the city has. So then the developers wouldn't come, the builders wouldn't come. You'd have building trades from carpenters to masons, from tilers to the furniture that goes into them, the bathrooms. All that would be industries affected. And so with more people having more money, 10.2 million millionaires, 17.8 professional class, meaning having up to $1 million, lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, professors, CPAs, they wouldn't move in these places. They're educated. They are going to look and see a risk assessment. They're going to say, no, I'm not going to go move down there. I don't care what the price is. You know, I could lose that in a year or two. So then I sold. And one of my friends who's a broker said, this is stupid, you know. And I said, well, it may be stupid today, but I look ahead. And what I see coming is an unsustainable environment. Now, that does not mean buildings are going to sink. It doesn't mean, you know, you're going to, you know, have to get a rowboat to get out of your apartment. But it does mean that every city in the United States is only functioning based upon the quality of its infrastructure. And a lot of that infrastructure, gas, electric, water, septic, is underground. From the subways in New York, and we saw how devastated they were with a little Category 1 Sandy. That was Category 1. And you can believe other categories are coming. Mm. So then my last, I sold my place, and then I went back, and on Alton Road, which is the main road that you go up, it was flooded. no storm, 18 inches of water every night. So then that was affecting people getting to Lincoln Road and all those apartments over on West Street and very expensive ones on the bay. So they put $220 million worth of these turbines in that would take water off the street, bring them through their flood drains, and push that water right back out into the bay. Well, the bay and the Atlantic are connected. It's only about a quarter mile, half a mile, that's it. You know, they're one body of water. It's like throwing water from the back of a boat that's sinking into the front. And the mayor even said, you know, this is not sustainable. Yet, here's the irony. It did not slow down people developing, buying apartments, market still in a boom stage. And I'm thinking, my goodness, you talk about living in complete denial of the consequences of your actions. So that's just one example of a city right now, as we speak, that you have to find higher ground in the Miami area, or your house then could end up getting lots of water in it. And then when you drive from Miami down through southern Florida, and then you go into the Keys. It's a very beautiful drive. You see the Atlantic to your left. You see the Gulf of Mexico to your right. And it's a one lane down and back. And you go through Key Largo. Now in the morning, it stinks to high heaven. There's mosquitoes everywhere. There's standing water from the night before. And people simply adapted to it. But has the real estate gone down? More people going away from it? No. So I'm seeing this happen where cities are no longer sustainable. Like Phoenix is simply no longer sustainable. I went to Sedona, which is a very important artistic community above, on the way up the state, an elevation, you go from Phoenix to the low end, Sedona in the middle, and then Flagstaff where the university is at the high end. Drought, you're seeing tree die-offs, you're seeing beetle infestations, you're seeing loss of water. In fact, the former mayor took me around when I was in Sedona, and he's telling me about how they're running out of water, and yet no one's moving. It's like, okay, we got these problems. Let's just deny them. So could you give us your perspective about what literally could happen and when could it happen if the Arctic goes ice-free?
Well, certainly everything you said is true. And I understand in Carolina, either North Carolina or South Carolina, I'm not sure which, there's a law that you can't officially mention sea level rise in any document relating to the business of the state, because presumably the real estate industry is terrified that people will stop buying coastal property. The state of Carolina is becoming something like King Canute. And so there will be a point at which the public will fall back from endlessly going for seemingly attractive options like moving to the southwest or moving to a nice location like Miami, because of the consequences become too obvious. I mean, you've I guess sold out at just the right time before things did become too obvious, but they will become more and more obvious, and people will just have to stop living there. The same thing happened to me that I used to work at an oceanographic laboratory for a while in a town called Oban on the west coast of Scotland, and we had an apartment in an absolutely beautiful block, Victorian building, right on the waterfront of Oban, looking out across to the Isle of Mull, so idyllic location, and we were on the top floor of the building, but while we were there, increasingly, the ground floor would get flooded. There would be a high tide or a storm would come in, sweep across the road, which was right on the waterfront, and flood the bottom floor of the apartment building. So since, of course, all the people who live in the apartment building have to pay for the insurance, and it was getting to be expensive for us, even though we were on the top floor and not getting flooded ourselves. So we ended up selling up and living without that view. So it's happening, and that building will be abandoned before too long, because the foundations are getting affected. So it's true that big changes will happen, and the changes will be noticed and will affect business. And there's a very good book that was published a year or so ago called High Tide on Main Street by John Englander, and that dealt with global warming, but primarily it dealt with sea level rise on the basis of real observations, not on the basis of the sort of complacent views of bodies like Intergovernmental Panel, but what's actually going on with the ice sheets and how fast they're melting, and what would be the consequences of the real sea level rise that we're going to get, which might be much more than a metre this century, and maybe several metres, and looking at that as a disaster for the economy because of the way in which very large areas of really busy cities and resort areas will just have to be abandoned, and as you say, they won't be abandoned because they're underwater. They'll be abandoned because there are progressive stages at which they become less and less habitable. And what's happening? What you've noticed about the basis on which a city is built? In the case of Miami, the pilings that go down into the sand. You can already see in advance what's going to happen from some of the cities in the Russian Arctic, which were also built on pilings, but they're pilings that were going down into the permafrost, and they thought the permafrost would last forever, but the permafrost is melting, and as it melts, that you find drunken looking buildings, that the buildings start leaning over, big cracks appearing, the buildings fall down, because the basis of the building, which is the pilings sunk into permafrost, is no longer capable of supporting that building. So that's what we're going to be is going to be happening noticeably. And so as sea ice retreats, that those things will happen. And the further thing, which you mentioned really at the beginning, and a further feedback, as I sort of mentioned, this methane feedback and the sea level feedback and the albedo feedback. But the other one, which is very questionable at the moment as to whether it's directly an effect of sea ice retreat, but it does seem that it might be, is this question of weather extremes and these extreme temperatures that you've mentioned. We're having the same. Yesterday's temperature in Britain was 35 centigrade, which is 95 Fahrenheit, which was the highest that we've ever had on Midsummer's Day in Britain. So that these kinds of extreme temperatures, and you have another whole load of statistics of extremely cold temperatures, of blizzards in at times when you don't expect them, really cold weather. And this all seems to be related to the fact that the jet stream, which separates the polar air at high latitudes from tropical air, is slowing down because the contrast, the winds that are involved are slowing down because the temperature difference between the polar regions and the tropics is going down because the Arctic is warming faster than the tropics. So the temperature difference between the Arctic and the tropics is going down. That causes the jet stream to slow down. And when the jet stream slows down, it ceases to be a more or less a straight line of wind separating these two air masses. It becomes, whenever an ocean current slows down, it goes into loops, it goes into eddies. And the jet stream is going into these lobes of where you have, instead of being a straight line, it's a big wavy line. And the wavy part of the line means that tropical air is being allowed to move much further north than it used to do. And similarly, polar air moves further south. And there's neighbouring regions going around the world where you have unusually cold air, unusually warm air, unusually cold air, unusually warm air. So these cause these weather extremes. And so long as a weather extreme only happens in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, perhaps, you can say, well, we mustn't be misled into thinking that weather is the same as climate. This is something meteorologists always say. You have an extreme event. It's just the extreme end of a random distribution. So if this only happened 1 or 2 years running, we could say yes. But it's now happened 7 years running, and those 7 years correspond to the years in which sea ice has been radically retreating in the Arctic. So it looks as if it's not becoming a weather extreme anymore, but a climate extreme. And this is giving us these exceptionally hot periods in certain longitudes, like the US Northeast, and exceptionally cold episodes at other longitudes. But the result of all that is that in the mid latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere, which is where a lot of people live and where most of the world's food is grown, you're getting extreme events, storms, and extreme heat or extreme cold, everything that's calculated to make it difficult to grow crops. So we're going to be finding, we already are finding, the price of food going up globally because crops are being affected by these weather extremes in just at the latitudes where you're trying to grow them most of all. So that will have big knock-on effects because if food is more difficult to grow at a time when world population is growing in a more or less uncontrolled way, we're going to have a big crunch of famine, of food supply, just not being able to keep pace with population increase. And this is coming upon us pretty soon.
Well, I'm looking at that now in different parts of the world. I'm studying food patterns, food distribution, food growth in Africa, Asia, in the subcontinent. And there are severe situations. There's over 180 million people living in the world right now who are affected by the environment, by the weather. And it's too dry. They don't have the water. Only 1% of the world's fresh water is actually available and drinkable. The majority of the water is not. And you look at the largest emitters of CO2 per population, and it's in Qatar, and then the United Arab Emirates. Ironic, because Qatar also has the highest standard of living per population. It's about $176,000 per person per year because they're this tiny little nation. And that abuts up to Saudi Arabia and other countries, and tiny nation, tiny population, but they have almost nothing they do themselves. Everything has to be imported, and they're in a desert constantly. So air conditioning and the fossil fuels they emit and use, so they're a big polluter. Yeah, they're a tiny microcosm of what it would be to be China. You know, you could put 1,000 Qatars in China or more, but you look at, all right, you're a person used to a certain diet. You're used to a high animal protein diet. Well, it's 56 to 68 times more methane is releasing CO2 to grow cattle and pigs and chicken. And most of the fish in the world is fed to cattle for its protein, when cattle, as an organic farmer, I can tell you, cattle don't eat animal proteins. In nature, they eat grasses, and they ruminate, and yet we're feeding them to get them to market faster, and it's just a completely lopsided scale, and that's creating massive amounts of pollution. Plus, they pollute the groundwater, they pollute the air, and of course, then they pollute our health. They cause a leading contributor to heart disease. In fact, I looked at over 5,000 peer-reviewed scientific studies on health and diet. I could not find one that supported a meat-based diet. In other words, there's no study that says eat beef and it's good for your breasts, it's good for your prostate, it's good for your heart, it's good for your cholesterol, triglycerides, C-reactive protein, homocysteine. It doesn't exist. But I can show you hundreds of studies that show by going to a plant-based diet, you improve your health, and of course you also lessen the effects and impact of pollution. In fact, if we were to eliminate eating animal proteins, which contributes about 17 to 18% of total global warming, that would be equivalent to all cars, planes, trains, buses, and ships combined. And yet we pay no attention to it. So on the one hand, we're dealing with an environmental issue, but on the other hand, we're dealing with a political, economic, and human nature issue. Politics will not make a difference in this whole mess, and economics will only benefit it if it can profit from it. The green capitalist like Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio, where Leonardo goes from the Cannes Film Festival to New Jersey to pick up an environmental award and flies there in a private jet, picks up the award and flies right back. There doesn't seem to be any irony in these contradictions. And then people say, yeah, I want to be healthy, and everything they do shows that they're eating themselves to death. So then we get to what can we do with the environment? Well, if you look at the Arctic, your specialization, and the Arctic polar ice and Greenland ice sheets, they are under assault. Why? Because of the mega oil companies to start deep sea drilling for oil. And this past April, Donald Trump signed an executive order to expand offshore oil and gas drilling and to reduce restrictions for oil drilling in the Arctic. And he has every intention to open up the Arctic for fossil fuel exploitation. And assuming that this drive for Arctic oil goes full tilt into hyperdrive, we are likely to see consequences that you now say are problematic, go from problematic to extreme. And just like the, you know, Deepwater Horizon, look at what it did to this day to aquatic life in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. That's one single oil, Derek, that exploded. Imagine if you had a major one that could not be fixed, that could not be, that was in a very intemperate environment. So here's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the fact that we are not now, nor will we be in the future, in any position to make a fundamental difference. Individually, we can do things. We can do, you know, go to a plant-based diet, buy paper instead of plastic, and stop buying so much stuff. But at the end of the day, ask the average person, ask the average environmentalist, ask Bill McKibben and others, are you a vegan? Are you buying locally, organically grown, sustainable food? Are you downsizing your standard of living? Are you moving to a more sustainable environment and living in harmony with that environment? Are you making your house, instead of a big house on the hill, are you building a nice berm house or using bale for your roofing? What are you doing exactly? And you'll find it's always good for them to talk about it, but rarely do they actually actualize it. So at this moment, I'm looking at between now and the next 5 years being the single most important time in our history for people as individuals and groups to address these issues, because no matter what any of us do, we have passed the point to do anything about at least 7 major tipping points that are tipping. Nothing we're going to do about it. But I also believe that in the very near future, the next year or two, we will double the amount of extreme weather events. This year we've had 12,000. And I believe that we also will get a wake-up call when we get a Category 5, which we've never had, hitting New York or Miami or on the west coast of Florida. And we were devastated when a Category 3 hit New Orleans, and they were ill-prepared. They're still ill-prepared, and people are still living there, moving back there, rebuilding there, just like people all up and down the east coast of the United States, especially in New Jersey, where Hurricane Sandy hit a Category 1. They've rebuilt, and I'm thinking, why? Nature hasn't retired. It's coming back. And so I'm for myself, I've moved to an environment that's 100% sustainable, a complete solar with backup redundant systems, hydroponic growing, and where soil is good, but also you don't have to rely upon the soil. You got the hydroponics, and you can heat or cool based upon the needs. And people look at me like, oh, gee, Gary, isn't that extreme? I said, what, you mean having a health insurance policy, a car insurance policy, flood insurance policy? That's not extreme, is it? Isn't that prudent? Well, why shouldn't I have a climate change policy and be living it? Is the quality of my life diminished because I'm doing this? Not at all. Now, let's just say that you who are criticizing me, thinking I'm extreme, eccentric, or someone, you know, who is emotionally unstable because of my thoughts, what happens when a category 3, 4, 5 hit your home? Is that what you need to wake up? So I just don't see us at this moment being emotionally, politically, or economically prepared to make fundamental changes, and I believe that it's going to hit the fan within the next 5 years. Now, societies never collapse all at once, and we have multiple societies, we have multiple economies. We have, when you have 10.2 million millionaires with four people per family, it's 40 million. When you have 17.8 professional class who are worth anywhere between a couple hundred thousand to $1 million, and you have four per family, so you're looking at almost around 80 million people who are going to do okay economically, but that's dependent upon also that the environment not extreme event not happening on them, or how they earn their income not being adversely affected, because you cut off most people's income. The professional class cannot sustain because they've been paying for a lifestyle as if they were millionaires, and they're not, sending their kids to private colleges, paying cash, letting them keep up with the rich kids when they're really not. It's all through debt, and we've got a ton of debt. We've got we're bankrupt as a nation economically. We have $18.6 trillion in gross domestic product. We have $162 trillion in debt and unfunded liabilities. So states, federal governments, the federal government, the states, and the city communities are bankrupt. They can't balance their budgets. People are holding an enormous amount of debt. Corporations are holding debt. And no one's looking at the consequences of the environment upon how they're going to pay that debt or sustain their lifestyle. So your final thoughts based upon what you see happening now?
I'd agree with what you said. I mean, people don't vector in climate change into their thinking or planning, and it applies to individuals, but it also applies to governments and whole nations. As you said with about DiCaprio, I was at the COP22 meeting in Marrakesh last year, the UN climate meeting, which was supposed to reinforce the Paris Agreement, but of course that was undermined because that was the very week that Trump was elected. The Marrakesh airport was absolutely full of private jets because the delegates from, say, Gulf states and so on, and many would fly in private jets, and then there were fleets of Mercedeses to drive them between their hotels and the conference place. And you sort of thought, well, what on earth is this meeting supposed to be about? But it's a case of not living the thing that you supposedly believe. And in some cases, you don't believe it either, because, for instance, with China, you're finding that as people become more affluent, they want to eat meat because they couldn't afford it before. They had to have purely rice with a tiny bit of fish on top of it, which is actually a very, very healthy diet. But instead, they now want pork and they want beef, and huge areas have been given over to this kind of meat, which is very, very wasteful use of space and use of resources. But the individual is some poor person who suddenly is getting a higher salary and can eat meat, and he wants to eat meat. So in a sense, as you can't blame them as individuals, but you can see that the really bad result on the planet. So there's a... It's, I'm in two minds about this, because there was an adage that a British climate change researcher said, David Mackay. He said, you know, if we all did a little about climate change, we did each did our own thing, and we all do a little, the result will be a little. And that was a kind of sadly cynical, but what he's saying is if individuals try to live in a more sustainable way, it won't affect the overall state of the planet as much as one hopes it would. What you need is action on a governmental basis, not on an individual basis. So, for instance, we could all try to live in insulate our houses and live not drive such big cars and so on. We can all have an individual way of living, which is better, but it pales into insignificance beside what a government could do in the way of having large projects for renewable energy, encouraging renewable energy, encouraging electric vehicles. The power of large-scale resources can achieve a huge amount. An enlightened national or government or supranational government is capable of achieving much more than the sum total of little individual efforts.
I agree with you. I just don't see them doing that till there's a catastrophic event that they are forced into doing it. When people suddenly say, how did this happen? We're victims. We blame you for your inertia, your hubris. Then they will come together and have maybe an environmental Marshall Plan. But by that time, Peter, I believe we will have gone past another group of tipping points. Finally, I need a real short answer on this because we're at the end of our program. Do you see the temperature rising very much if we have 3 or 4 straight years of ice-free Arctic?
Yes, I do, because this has already happened. That in 2015, I was out in the Arctic Ocean in October and November when the ice is supposed to be advancing after the summer retreat. And in fact, it wasn't advancing nearly as much as it was normally does, because the ice was so far back, there was so much open water, and that had absorbed so much heat, that as the ice started to try and grow outwards again, it couldn't do so because there was too much heat being brought up by the water column and through waves and storms. And every time there was a little advance, it would be beaten back again. So if you look at the ice area curve, for last year, you find that after this unusual autumn of 2015, when the ice didn't advance, it was a laggard all the way through the winter and into the following spring and summer, because it hadn't been able to do its early season advance. So that means that every year when we have an unusually low area of ice, which we're getting every summer now, then the recovery of the ice during the winter is much slower. So you end up with a lower area of ice in midwinter as well, and then that means there's less ice to melt the following summer. So it will have a cumulative feedback effect, and we can expect that the results that flow from that, like weather extremes, will continue and get worse, in fact.
And I believe in the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see a portion of the farmland in much of the Americas no longer being able to be growing the grains that they historically have and vegetables, because the plants cannot adapt in such a short period of time. I want to thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, Professor Peter Wadham. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying.